Last week we looked at some of the various ways in which we can understand Hinduism. We've seen it's a little problematic, it's a little difficult, partly because largely because the term Hindu sort of shifts over time as what it actually refers to. Is it a geographical designation? Is it a cultural, religious designation that separates what we now call Hindus from Muslims? Is it a self-designation is connected with a strong ideology or a strong theology as we find arising in the 19th century? Is it a racial, cultural term as it is for for Savarkar and Hindu nationalists who claim there is a Hindutva, there is a Hinduness? And you might have sort of left last week's class wondering then, well, so what really is Hinduism? How can we define Hinduism? How can we understand what it is that all these traditions that now call themselves Hindu, why do they call themselves Hindu? Basically any textbook you open on Hinduism, any introduction to Hinduism will have its own answer, and various people will offer various definitions. Sometimes based on certain ideas that all Hindus share, sometimes based on certain practices that they have in common, and so on. Some would say, well, caste is a defining element of Hinduism. Some will say, no, it's belief in rebirth, or belief in liberation, or it's belief in Brahman. Some will say it's rules of purity that they uphold. Some will say it's an adherence to a certain corpus of texts, and so on. And all these things are true of a lot of Hindu traditions, but it's, as we will see, not all Hindu traditions actually share all of these principles, all of these ideas, or all of these practices. And so it's a bit like you have this sort of group of traditions that developed alongside each other over centuries. And they all have sort of, there's a reason from the 12th century onwards, Hindus start to see themselves as Hindus in opposition to Muslims, because they do recognize we do have things in common. There's sort of family resemblances that we share. But just as if you think of your extended family, there are physical features, for example, that sort of you share with your extended family, that if you see your extended family together, it's kind of, you can say, oh yeah, these people belong to the same family. They are all kind of, there's, you know, this person has the same nose as this person, and as this person, and this person has the same eyes, and so on, and this person the same ears or same hair, and so on. But there likely isn't one thing that every single member of that family has in common. And so it's similar with the Hindu traditions. One definition that you had on last week's handout that is quite useful as a starting point, though, and that ties in with today's class, is the definition that Brian Smith gave. And it's a very famous definition that if you read any introductory textbook on Hinduism, you'll see it's kind of referred to frequently, where he argued that Hinduism consists of traditions define themselves, develop themselves, and renew themselves reference to the legitimizing authority of the Vedas. And so the Vedic texts are seen as important for most Hindu traditions, and we'll see there's some exceptions to this. Today, if you ask Hindus, what's your sacred text, many of them will say the Vedas. Even if most of them have no idea what's actually in the Vedas, don't engage with these texts. These texts are rarely used in ritual performances, even today, among most Hindus. But still, they're sort of revered as seen as the origins of everything that Hindus are doing today. And so it's not that. Brian Smith's definition is that these traditions develop and renew themselves and reform themselves with reference to the authority of the Vedas. So you'll find Hindu traditions throughout the centuries doing certain things and saying, we do this because this is Vedic, because this is told in Vedic texts. We'll see that this is a somewhat problematic claim in some ways in this term. And but that there is also a reason why Hindu traditions do that. That there is, you can sort of see the rationale behind it. There are Hindu traditions, though, that see themselves really as outsiders of the Vedic tradition, that still share a lot of family resemblance with the other traditions, but that do position themselves as saying, we have nothing to do with these Vedic texts. Our path, the practices we follow, the theology we have, is of a superior nature, and so we don't care about that. And that doesn't, in a way, kind of, that does problematize the definition that Brian Smith gives, but it doesn't sort of nullify it or make it invalid. If we think of it in terms of, if we think of defining Hinduism in slightly different terms than we normally define things. Normally we define things and say, okay, this is what a chair is, and every instance of a chair neatly corresponds to that definition. But there's also a different way of thinking about defining a thing. You can say, okay, a chair is, you have, if I say think of a chair, you'll likely think of something, a flat surface with four legs and probably a back to it. But chairs, they form all sorts of shapes. And so you can think of defining something as defining a prototype of an object or of a thing, and saying this is a prototypical chair, this is the prototype of a chair. And all the other chairs that don't exactly resemble this thing, but do, or we do call a chair, still fall within that because they share enough of those elements. And so we might say, well, if you have, you know, you have these sort of modern chairs that are like this, that doesn't have four legs and so on, but we can still recognize this as a chair. If you deviate too much from it, we might say, well, you know, if you have something like this, you know, then you might say, well, that's a stool and that's not a chair. And so, but there are sort of parameters in the sense that we can say, okay, this still qualifies as sort of an instance of a chair, and that sort of corresponds closely enough to the prototype of a chair. And so if we think of Hinduism in that sense, we can define Hinduism in a particular way by saying, here, you know, if you have all these characteristics and you say, okay, the ones that will place closer to the center are those that are shared by more traditions. So if we say, okay, we have the authority of the Veda, we have issues of purity, we have a belief in rebirth and so on. And so these are elements that are shared by a larger group of traditions. But you might have, for example, you have transgressive ritual practices that you find in tantric traditions. They kind of fall on the outskirts, and they're sort of not as typical of Hindu traditions as a whole. But we can sort of say, okay, well, everything that sort of is shared by most traditions, or by more traditions than others, that we use as to define a, sort of a prototypical Hindu. And everything else we can sort of define, we can sort of understand in relation to that. So if we think of it in that sense, what we will see is some of the things we'll talk about today would sort of fall more in sort of towards the center, not the very center, but sort of or sort of going more towards the center. And even when other Hindu traditions react against that and say, no, we don't believe that, we don't accept this, we don't practice this, we don't think this is valid, and so on, and sort of have certain elements that fall further away from this, still there are certain core sort of principles that link them to this, and that can therefore be sort of said to be Hindu, just as this can be said to be a chair, just as, you know, this is a chair. Now, that said, the Vedas are often, as we've seen last week already, a lot of Hindu traditions claim the authority of the Veda, and we've seen the distinction between Astika and Nastika, between those who say Asti, there is the authority of the Vedas, which we now call the Hindu traditions, and those who say Nasti, there is not, which is there is the authority, the Veda has no authority, which are Buddhist and Jainism and other schools like that. A lot of Hindu traditions do claim that the Veda is authoritative, and part of that claim, or sort of there's a debate surrounding that claim, which is then, okay, well, what do the Veda actually teach? And that's a bigger question that we'll see is sort of the running thread through this term. We'll see every group of texts we'll look at sort of is teaching something with reference back to the Vedic texts and claiming, well, this is really what the Vedic texts are saying. What I want to do today is look at the Vedic texts in and of themselves and looking at those practitioners, those Hindus who only follow the Vedic texts and do not follow other texts. So it's those purely engaged with those texts, whereas later on we'll see there are other groups who also claim the Veda sort of is teaching what they're teaching, but they're accepting a whole bunch of other texts as well. Now, the Vedas are fairly complicated. You have a table here at the top of the handout, which is behind you. And there's more text than you have on this chart, but this is just to simplify and to kind of make it somewhat intelligible and hopefully not too bewildering. But essentially, when people talk about the Vedas, they talk about four sort of groups of texts. And those are the texts you have here at the top, the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda, and Atharva Veda. These are four, as it says there on the side, these are four samhitas, or four collections, four things that are put together. And they're four collections of very specific types of texts. The Rig Veda is a collection of rich of hymns to various gods, with a few other sort of hymns thrown in, but mostly hymns to the various Vedic gods. The Sama Veda is the collection of psalms, of chants, sort of chants that are recited, that are sung actually during the most important Vedic rituals, and we'll say a bit more about that. The Yajur Veda is the Veda of the Samhita, the collection of yajus, of ritual formulas, of what most people would nowadays call mantras, of mostly prose passages that are recited by the principal priest during the ritual, whenever he does a ritual action and says, you know, this is what I'm doing now, and so on, or this is the offering for such and such. The Atharva Veda is slightly more complex and doesn't fit too neatly in that sort of categorization, because it's in a sense a more composite text. There's a wider range of types of passages that you find in there. The Atharva Veda deals partly with rituals that are more domestic in nature, the birth of a child, the death of a relative, the building of a house, and these sort of things. It also deals with what most people would call sort of more magical rituals, there's a lot of sort of charms and spells and so on in there, a lot of healing rituals, but also rituals for making someone fall in love with you, making someone not fall in love with you, making someone fall in love with someone else, and so on. There are things like that in there. But then the third type of passages that you find in the Atharva Veda, and these are important for when we look at the Upanishads, are more philosophical passages. There's a large collection of hymns, if you want, or verses that reflect more philosophically about the nature of reality, about existence, about the nature of the world, about the self, and so on, and the foundation of everything. And it's kind of the first three of the Vedas, the Rig, the Sama, and the Ajurveda. These are really, as we will see, these are the core of Vedic ritual practice. The Atharva Veda is generally not used in the most important Vedic rituals, and you'll find in Hindu text often references to the three Vedas, which are the first three, which are sort of seen as being separate from, in somewhat different in status than the fourth, the Atharva Veda. What do these texts actually teach? I mean, as you can see, as I mentioned, you have hymns, you have chants, you have ritual formulas that are recited during ritual. As sort of the nature of these texts itself suggests, these texts are all about ritual. And these texts are ritual texts, both in the sense that they're used in ritual, they're recited in ritual, they're performed, as it were, in ritual, but also because they talk about ritual. And we'll see more, the other texts you have on there or fall more in that category. But they're ritual texts in those two senses. They're used in ritual and they talk about ritual. And the rituals they talk about are kind of rituals that are, in a sense, the basic principle of the ritual is fairly simple, but they there's a lot of variation on them, and they do get a lot more complicated as sort of the ritual lengthens. But essentially, the rituals are fire rituals. They're rituals where offerings are made into fire, and to the various Vedic gods. Now, in order to understand the significance of that, I have to say a little bit about sort of the worldview that these texts teach. And it's basically the Vedic texts, they worship a range of gods, and which are by mostly not the gods that most Hindus worship today. They're a different group of gods that Hindus today kind of accept and that are referred to in the texts that most Hindus do engage with, but they're kind of a different set of gods that are almost exclusively worshipped in these Vedic rituals. And most of these gods are gods that have a connection to the natural world. And so you'll find a lot of the gods are so to put it sort of simply, sort of nature gods. They're gods that control various elements of nature. You have, for example, the chief of the gods, Indra, who's the king of the gods, who is the god of rain. Rain and thunder. Agni, which literally means fire, is the god of fire. Surya, who is the god of the sun. You have Vayu, who is the god of the wind. You have the Maruts, which are the gods of storms. You have rivers as goddesses. You have earth as a goddess. You have sort of various Vedic gods that are sort of the sort of personifications, if you want, of natural forces. But they're a bit more complicated than that as well, because they do have a number of gods are more than just the personifications of natural elements, but also have strong ethical sort of connotations, or sort of govern over ethical principles. Indra, for example, is the god of rain and thunder, but is also the god of war. Because he's the king of the gods, he fights the battles of the gods. He is the god of war as well, and he's often invoked in hymns in sort of the context of war. You have a very important deity that we will see a bit more about in a moment, Varuna, who rules over water, like the ocean and so on, but is also, more importantly in Vedic text, is connected with a principle we'll say a bit more about in a moment, Rita, or order, and as there's a very strong ethical sort of dimension to Varuna. You have a god that's generally invoked alongside Varuna, Mitra, which literally means friend, and is the god of friendship, of sort of good relations between people and so on, and interact sort of, so sort of a more social dimension to it. And so but the basic idea is that we as human beings were born into this world, and we occupy a very small part of this enormous universe. We are born into a particular family, into a particular community, it's the important thing the Vedic texts are saying is that we recognize that. We see ourselves not as individuals, but as part of a bigger whole. And that's the basic principle of Vedic text. Our identity is not determined by our individuality, but by our relations with other beings. And those other beings include our parents, our brothers, sisters, our extended family, our teachers, our ancestors, but also the natural world and the beings that govern the natural world. We live, the Vedic texts emphasize, because of all these circumstances. We live because our ancestors were, because of our ancestors, because our ancestors gave us our parents, who gave us birth, and so we have a sort of an obligation towards them. We live because there is sun and rain and heat and wind and all these elements, and therefore we have an obligation towards the natural world, as it were, and so on. And so our identity is not is always determined by our relations with others, by our place within the bigger whole. And this bigger whole, this is Ritta. And Ritta is variously translated. It's often translated as sort of cosmic order or cosmic harmony or something like that. And it's basically the idea that there is an order in this world. There's a sort of a structure in this world that we are sort of part of, where everything kind of works as it should. The seasons follow each other. The day follows night. It's cold in the winter. It's warm in the summer. There's the rainy season in India and so on. So these cycles kind of operate as they should. These things, the world works the way it works, and the way the world sort of works in this ordered way, because the constituent elements of those things function properly in sort of the bigger whole. So if you think of, like, you have a big machine and sort of all the cogs kind of, the machine works because all the cogs are in the right place and they're all sort of turning, but you take a cog out and put it somewhere else, then the machine will break. That's kind of to put it crudely, the basic idea behind it. And so one of the important elements, of course, is that the gods are upholders of Ritta. The gods uphold Ritta because they govern the natural elements and they're guardians of Ritta. Varuna in particular is said to be the guardian, but all the gods kind of contribute to the Ritta, and they maintain the order, they sustain the succession of seasons, the succession of day and night, and so on. And the reason they have to do this is because there's another group of beings who are the siblings of the gods, and who are, particularly in later Vedic texts, are called the Asuras, where Sura is gods and Asuras, so they're the anti-gods, as it were. This is often translated as demons, but I think the term demon kind of conjures up all sorts of sort of horrific creatures from Christian mythology and so on, that doesn't apply to them. These are essentially beings like the gods, but the difference between these two, and they're siblings of the gods, so they're sort of part of the extended family of the gods, but they're anti-gods because their interest is very different from the gods that are worshipped in Vedic ritual, because their interest is selfish. Their interest is about themselves, about power, about self-aggrandizement, a self-centered sort of view. And so these two are competing with each other for rule of the world, basically. The Asuras want to rule it for themselves. The Suras, the gods, the Devas, in theory at least, we'll see that gets a bit more problematic in later texts, they want to rule it to maintain Dritta, to maintain the order of the world. Now, we fit into this because, as I said, we're born with a debt to the gods, because the gods give us everything that we need to live. And so in order to live a responsible life, to live a life related to Dritta, we have to make offerings to the gods. And the idea behind the offerings that are made to the gods changes a little bit, or is kind of variously expressed in various Vedic texts. If you read the hymns in the Rig Veda, for example, we make offerings to the gods mostly because out of gratitude for what the gods have given us. We give offerings because the gods are worthy of offerings. But there's another element to that that becomes more, that's emphasized more in some of the other Vedic texts, and that is that it isn't just that we make offerings to the gods out of gratitude, by which they then reciprocate and give us everything that we need to live a comfortable life. And so we make offerings to Indra for rain, we make offerings to Pushan, who's the god of the roads and traveling, to ensure a safe passage and so on. And we don't just do it for that reason, but there's also another element to this, and that is that the offerings that we make to the gods are, as it were, the food of the gods. The gods live on the offerings that are made to them. And so it's in later texts, and particularly in theological schools that develop a theology based purely on Vedic texts, you get the notion that the gods are actually dependent on sacrifice, on rituals that we perform. And so in later theological traditions, you get the argument that when I make an offering to Indra, it is not that Indra sort of looks upon me and says, oh, look at this person, he's made such a nice offering to me, I'm so pleased with him, that therefore I will give him abundantly, you know, rain, which will give him crops and so on. But rather that when I make an offering to Indra, Indra is forced to reciprocate, because Indra is part of Ritta, part of the order of the world. And so when offerings are made to the gods, then the gods reciprocate naturally. Just as if I light fire, then, you know, if I light wood, then fire will come out of it. There's no sort of choice in terms of the wood to kind of say, oh, I want to burn, I don't want to burn. The wood is kind of, you know, just, it's kind of a fairly mechanical sort of way. And this is not quite what you find in Vedic texts. These are later theological developments. But you do find, you don't find it to that degree in Vedic texts, but you do find particularly in the second group of texts you have on the handout there, the Brahmanas, which are a group of texts that are associated with each of the four Vedas, and you see you have sort of each of them have their own distinct titles. So the Rig Veda has the Aitareya and the Kaushitaki Brahmana, the Samaveda, the Jaiminiya Brahmana, and so on. And these are texts that are mostly in prose, and they really emphasize the power of ritual. They develop their ritual texts, not in the sense that they're used in ritual, but they talk about ritual. And they place ritual at the very heart of everything and say everything is sustained by ritual. And ritual is the Vedic ritual, or the yajna, the sacrifices, is actually where the power is. And the gods are kind of dependent on this. The gods live on this. And so in the Brahmana text, you get the idea that this is our responsibility to make offerings to the gods, because if we don't make offerings to the gods lose their power, and the asuras can take over, and then chaos comes about. And so you get in Brahmana text, you get these various meditations that are given on ritual, where they say that the Brahman who performs in the morning the Agnihotra, which is a very simple, short ritual that they're supposed to perform every morning at sunrise, every evening at sunset. You get Brahmana texts who say when a Brahman performs this in the morning, he causes the sun to rise. And when a Brahman performs this in the evening, he causes the sun to set. And it isn't sort of, that might sort of seem, well, that's a bit sort of an exaggeration. These texts are not saying that me, just by my performing of the ritual, if I don't perform my ritual, the sun will not rise. But it's the idea of this ritta. It's by performing this offering in the morning, I contribute to this ritta. I play my part in the bigger whole. And by playing my part in the bigger whole, the offerings are made to the various gods. And because the gods gain the various offerings, therefore the order of the world is sustained. And therefore the sun will continue to rise. So it's kind of a statement of sort of the bigger significance of sacrifice. And so in a sense, what these texts are saying is not that the power is in me to make the sun rise and set, but the power is in the ritual to make the sun rise and set in sort of the bigger sense. There's a lot of a lot of there's this sort of basic idea, and particularly the sort of distinction between these two, is it pervades the Vedic text.
May I ask a question now?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, perhaps three questions. The first one is about Rita. If this order has some moral component, because some people connect the notion of Rita with the notion of dharma. Mm-hmm. If already there is a moral, an ethical component. And the second question is, you mentioned Indra, that he's the king of gods. So we know that Hinduism today, that there is a kind of hierarchy, and some gods are put in a higher place. If we find that also in the early texts.
Yeah, we'll come back to that later.
Okay. Huh. And then finally, the third one about the Asuras. The Samhitas, they put them on the same level as the gods.
In the sense that they're the siblings of the gods, yeah. And so they're similar in power. They're different in their understanding of sort of the world and in their interests. And so they have a selfish motivation, whereas they don't. I don't want to take too many questions now, because then we'll. But just briefly.
I don't know if you're done or not. Sorry. The individual Asura gods, if they're selfish and individualistic, are they competing with each other as well, or are they collectively working together to be selfish?
Yeah, you do find sort of references to them fighting amongst themselves as well. But generally, their sort of main motivation is to sort of overthrow these.
Take from them.
Yeah.
So did Sura become Vishnu, and then did Asura become Brahma? Is that what the...
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because isn't there a parallel between Vishnu and Brahma, and, you know, Vishnu the preserver, Brahma the... creator?
They would both be placed in this category.
Both those gods would be in the Sura.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There is definitely a very strong moral component to this, that, you know, it is to not act in accordance with Rita is kind of condemnable. It's something that's, you know, it's not a proper way to act. It's morally sort of, if you don't do it, you're morally corrupt and so on. And it is, as we will see later, next week, the notion of Rita is becomes very closely connected with the notion of dharma, which is used in Vedic texts, but not that frequently. But that becomes sort of the key term in other texts. And so that is very strongly connected. Now, the Asuras, one of the recurring images that you find in Vedic texts is a symbolism of light and darkness. It's the sort of the difference between the two is often said to be in terms of light and darkness, where light, the gods themselves, they're called the devas, which is derived from the root div, to shine, to be luminous. And so the devas are luminous beings, they're effulgent beings. Even, you know, you have a goddess of night, for example, even she's said to be luminous, because she's the star-covered night. And so she's sort of the bright night with the stars, which we don't experience much these days because we live in cities with light pollution and so on. But if you're in sort of small communities and with no artificial lighting, the night is kind of generally quite bright, if it's not clouded. And so these are all luminous beings. And whereas the Asuras are often portrayed as sort of dark beings or beings that embody darkness. In the sense that, I mean, if you think about it, light is something that moves outwards, and that's kind of often a symbolism that you find in it, and that sort of, you know, influences those around you, whereas sort of darkness sort of throws you upon yourself. If you're in the dark, you know, you're not aware of anything around you. And this is a symbolism that you find throughout Vedic texts. You get the, for example, kings are called Rajas. Raj is to shine, to be effulgent. And it's this idea that the king who rules in accordance with sort of Vedic ideas, he's effulgent, he's luminous, because his fame and his concern for the people sort of radiates outwards from him. And whereas the Asuras don't do that, their concern is just purely about themselves. But you see this also in Vedic rituals that are performed. Vedic rituals are generally performed at moments of transition from light to dark or dark to light. You see it, the Vedic rituals are performed, for example, the Agnihotra at sunrise and sunset, when it's transitioned from dark to light and light to dark. You have rituals that are performed at the full and the new moon, from, you know, when the moon sort of goes from waxing into waning and the other way. You have, sort of most rituals are performed at some of those moments of juncture, at the transition from season to season, when the sun kind of moves into sort of different in the, I'm not a great astronomer, but sort of in sort of the ecliptic and so on, when that moves differently. But one of the things that you find too in Vedic texts, or one of the ways that this used to be read in 19th century texts, was as a distinction between light as not so much as sort of a quality, but rather as a color. So as light people versus dark people. And in 19th century texts, this was read in very racial terms, where you had sort of light-skinned people who were in opposition to dark-skinned people. And that basically the descriptions that you find of the battles between the gods and the asuras in Vedic texts are really descriptions of conflicts that took place on you know, in northwestern India, which is the geography of most of these texts. And this was linked to the idea that that the Vedic people, as we mentioned last week, were not indigenous to India, but initially the idea was they invaded India and supplanted the sort of conquered the local people who were dark-skinned, and that you had sort of the lighter-skinned people that moved in with their fair-skinned gods who were fighting the dark-skinned gods of the local inhabitants. Hardly anyone still believes a narrative like that, where you had sort of these warriors invading northwestern India, conquering the local people. Most scholars who do believe that the Vedic people, or the Aryans, as they call themselves in Vedic texts, came from outside India, those scholars who believe that would argue that it was a migration rather than an invasion that took place over generations. The Vedic people, as we read in Vedic texts themselves, they're semi-nomadic people. They're people that sort of move around and settle. They're mostly tending cattle and doing agriculture, but they move around and then settle in a particular place and then move on again. And so gradually they migrated into northwestern India and came to rule northwestern India, sort of gradually supplanting the local culture that was there. Most scholars don't see Aryan as a racial term in these Vedic texts, but rather as a reference to people who perform Vedic rituals and who sort of share these cultural values, which has no sort of real racial designation. In more recent, actually for about 100 years, it sort of starts in the late 19th century, initially Indians started questioning this sort of narrative, particularly when it was sort of the model of the invasion, and saw it sort of match too closely the idea that you had people from a white island somewhere to the west sort of came in smaller numbers to India and were able to sort of conquer India and now rule the dark-skinned natives. Nationalists particularly saw this as sort of a colonial narrative that they're projecting onto the past and reacted against that and argued that the Vedic people were indigenous to India and have always lived there. It's a view that nowadays is very popular in India, particularly with nationalists. Strangely enough, Savarkar seems to be not sort of questioning that, whose text on Hindutva is sort of the foundation of it. And it's kind of been an ongoing debate in the academic world, where it's not so clear cut as sort of a distinction between Western scholars and Indian scholars. A lot of Indian scholars argue that there was a migration. A number of Western scholars argue that there was no migration, and it's kind of a debate that's ongoing. It's a debate that it's kind of quieted down a little bit. In the 1990s, it was enormously fierce, people not really sort of talking to each other, but more shouting at each other about what the correct way of reading it all is. The reason I mention this is because if you read some of these texts, on the surface, it does kind of, it's easy to sort of take it as sort of this light-skinned versus dark-skinned. But really what they're talking about is sort of a broader issue of, it's not a racial issue, but it's sort of a symbolism that they use in these texts. Most scholars that argue for a migration are not sort of, don't read these texts in racial terms anymore. As far as I know, the people that read them in racial terms are far right in sort of white supremacists in the West who do sort of write about this. as sort of a justification for the supremacy of the white sort of white people who were able to conquer, even though they were smaller in number, they were able to conquer these dark-skinned people. So you find still sort of racial interpretations of this in sort of far-right white supremacist circles, but that's kind of mostly sort of it. And that's sort of mostly it's sort of confined to that. Mostly the idea is that, you kind of see it, you know, sort of this, the term Aryan becomes used by Nazis in the second, sort of around the Second World War. To what extent that included Indians or not, that's sort of a problematic issue. Some liked Indians and sort of saw them as part of the same heritage in some ways. Some, like Hitler, really didn't like Indians and looked down upon them. But anyway, that's kind of that's the origin of this term. One of the complex issues with these texts is that these texts, as I said, are ritual texts. They're ritual texts because they're used in ritual or because they talk about ritual. But they're ritual texts in perhaps a more profound sense than we generally appreciate. Because if you read these texts, the central concern of everything they're saying is always ritual. And they're ritual texts in the sense that their whole significance only comes out in the performance of ritual. You see this, if you read the Vedic text as sort of a text, as a group of texts that teach you about the world and about the nature of the gods and so on, as sort of theological treatises, you'll be very confused and you'll think these texts are totally incoherent self-contradictory and so on. And there's you see this, for example, in the Rig Veda itself, you have these various gods that are praised there, and you read a hymn to Indra, and the hymn will say, Indra is the greatest of the gods, Indra upholds the universe, separates, you know, the earth from heaven, fights the asuras, and is the maintainer of Rita. You go to a hymn to Varuna, and so you get Indra controls all the other gods. You go to Varuna, and it says, no, Varuna rules all the gods because he controls Rita, and all the gods are subordinate to Rita. Varuna is the supreme of all the gods. You go to hymns to any of the other gods, you go to hymns of Agni, and Agni is the best of all the gods. And it seems to kind of contradict sort of each other, you know. But if you think of it in terms of performance, of ritual performance, it actually makes sense in the sense that the way they look upon the gods is they have a hierarchy where Indra is Indra itself means leader. Indra is the king of the gods, and there's talk about that. But during ritual, when the various gods are worshipped, each of the gods are praised as supreme, as now I'm worshipping Agni, and Agni is the only god I care about at this point, and Agni for me is now supreme, so I will worship Agni. And everything that can be said about other gods, I can say about Agni, because he's the only one that matters right now. And when I move on in my ritual and I then worship Indra, I can worship Indra as the best of all the gods, as the, you know, the person who keeps everything going and sustains us and so on. And so there's a very different sense in which you read this, if you think of this as performative text rather than as theological treatises that teach us something about the world, as sort of saying, okay, here's how you have to understand it. Max Müller is sort of the first sort of big person to draw attention to this. He argued that what we find in Vedic texts is not a polytheism where you have poly, sort of many gods that are worshipped, but not a monotheism either where you just have a single god that is worshipped to the exclusion of other gods, but what he first called henotheism and later called kathenotheism, where henos in Greek means one, but not one only. And kateno kind of means like one after the other. And so he argued that what the Vedic texts teach is a henotheism or a kathenotheism, where they worship one god, but in succession. So they'll worship first Agni as the only god, then Indra as the only god, then Varuna as the only god, and so on, as the ritual sort of prescribes it. And this comes out particularly in, there's a number of hymns in Vedic texts where this really comes out strongly, where you get hymns to one particular deity, say Indra, and it just says, "O Indra, you are Varuna, you are Vayu, you are Agni, you are Surya, you are Soma," and so on. You get these long sort of lists of, and it's kind of, contemporary Hindus will often read this as saying, oh, what they're saying is all these gods are one, and in a higher sense, they're all manifestation of sort of the unmanifest Brahman or something. That's not how these texts see it themselves. These texts sort of do see a clear distinction between the gods, but see the gods as sort of stand-ins for each other, as it were. You can worship one as the other when the ritual prescribes it, because it's sort of I think the term kathenotheism is quite sort of useful. It's sort of one after the other, you worship them. But you see this sort of importance of ritual also in these other texts, these Brahmanas. And these are, as I said, these are prose texts that in a sense they're often called sort of commentaries on the four main samhitas, on the four main collections. But they're not commentaries in sort of the traditional sense. They're more kind of texts that elaborate on ritual ideas that are associated with those four Vedic texts. And a lot of what they do is they if you sort of open any of those texts, they seem to be sort of standard texts on sort of mythology. You know, they give sort of the stories of various gods, and including they give accounts of creation, how the world came to be. Now, if you read these texts, and particularly these creation accounts, you'll find not one creation account, but you'll find a lot of different creation accounts, which all are different. There are sort of certain ideas that they share with each other, but they're all they contradict each other about how the world actually came to be in sort of the form that it is now, the reason for that is, again, is what these texts are talking about is not about the world and the creation of the world, but what these texts are talking about is ultimately ritual. And I gave you an example of this at the back of the handout. You have a passage from the Shatapatha Brahmana, the Brahmana of 100 paths, which is the longest of the Brahmanas, which is a sort of a typical creation account. I'll just read a few passages from it. But I recommend you kind of read through it. There's a handout probably somewhere. And so these accounts always start in the same way, that Prajapati, the lord of creatures, who's seen as a sort of the creator, and who in later texts is identified with Brahma, with the creator. So there you have it. They always start, Prajapati alone indeed existed here in the beginning. He was the only being that existed. And he considered how may I be reproduced, how can I multiply myself. He toiled, he performs ascetic practices which generate heat, which generate tapas, a notion we'll see more about later in this term. And through the ascetic practices that generate that heat, he generated Agni from his mouth. So these ascetic practices generate heat within the body, and the heat manifests as Agni. The beginning of this sort of the story of Prajapati was in the beginning, he wanted to reproduce himself and he performed tapas. That's the standard sort of introduction to all these accounts. And then it says, so Agni, the god of fire, sort of arises from his mouth. And because he generated him from his mouth, therefore Agni is the consumer of food. And truly, he who thus knows Agni to be consumer of food himself becomes a consumer of food. So Agni devours things. You feed Agni and you feed him wood and so on, and Agni will consume it because he's generated from the mouth. And if you then sort of skip the next paragraph, which gives sort of an etymology of the word Agni, Prajapati then considered, in that Agni I've generated a food eater for myself, but indeed there is no other food here but myself, whom surely he would not eat. At that time, this earth had indeed been rendered quite bald. There were neither plants nor trees. This then weighed on his mind. So Prajapati generates Agni. Agni is someone who has to be fed, but there's nothing for Agni to feed on apart from Prajapati himself. And as it then says, thereupon Agni turns toward Prajapati with open mouth, and Prajapati, being terrified, his own greatness departed from him. So Agni sort of runs towards Prajapati and says, well, he has to eat something, so Prajapati is the only one that's there, so he's going to eat Prajapati. And the description that you then get is kind of, it's kind of this colorful story of Prajapati sort of trying to ward off Agni and trying to appease Agni in various ways, and he rubs his hands and he has hair on the palm of his hands and the hair falls off and that's kind of offered, and there's an offering of milk that is made and so on. And so you get these various things that Prajapati is trying to do to appease Agni, and then at the end you get, if you look at the second column there, and Prajapati, having performed offering, do you see this is the third paragraph from the bottom? Prajapati, having performed offering, reproduced himself and saved himself from Agni, who is death, as he was about to devour him. And truly, whosoever knowing this offers the Agnihotra, reproduces himself by offspring, even as Prajapati reproduced himself and saves himself from Agni, or death, when he's about to devour him. And when he dies and when they place him on the fire, the person who performs the Agnihotra, then he is born again out of fire, and the fire only consumes his body. Even as he is born from his father and mother, so he is born from the fire. But he who offers not the Agnihotra, truly, he does not know, he does not come into life at all. Therefore, the Agnihotra should by all means be offered. And you kind of read this story, and you have a lot of stories like this, and if at the end you kind of get a passage like this generally, that sort of links it to a particular ritual, and that says, he who performs this ritual, meditating on this, meditating in this case on Agni as death, as the one who devours everything, as the one into whom you will be offered at the end during cremation, then you, Agni will not kill you, but you, Agni will give birth to you again in a body in heaven amongst the gods after you've performed the offerings. And once you look at these texts in that way, and you sort of put emphasis on the end, and if you know what the Agnihotra is and what it consists of, and you read this text as those people who would have read, you know, the people for whom who study these texts, they're all performing these rituals. So they read this text and they see that everything that Prajapati is said to have done is actually step by step what you do in an Agnihotra in some way. And so these are typical of all these accounts. You get these sort of creation accounts, but they're always coming down to sort of just, as it were, sort of a mythological telling of a particular ritual that you perform. And so what they're saying is that when you perform this ritual, here's how you can meditate on this. These are not saying this is exactly how the world came into being, but when you're performing this, you're like Agni, you're like Prajapati, you're like the performer of the sacrifice is like the creator, because he creates a future world for himself, he creates offspring for himself through the ritual. And so you become like Prajapati in the sense that, you know, you are also a creator. Here's how you then meditate on these rituals. And you get various meditations like that for, even for the same rituals, you get a lot of meditations like this. I mean, sort of various stories that are told about the Agnihotra, you get them also about other stories. And so if you read these texts, they're not there to sort of say, this is exactly how the world came to be, but they're there to sort of infuse your meditation during the performance of ritual. And that's what I mean when they're sort of ritual texts, even when they're talking about ritual, they gain their significance only when you actually perform the ritual. And this is something that becomes especially important in the school of Mimamsa that we'll see more about later on, which is a theological school that bases its entire thought on the Vedic text, where this becomes a very important argument for them, and that these texts are purely performative texts and nothing else. So when we perform our rituals, we make offerings to the gods, and by doing that we sustain Ritta, but we also in a sense become like the gods, in the sense that during the performance of the ritual, I become like Prajapati. I become like Prajapati in this case because, you know, in sort of my relationship with Agni, in other texts I become like Prajapati because I give birth to the sun in the morning, and so you get these sort of meditations. And at night I carry, and when I perform the Agnihotra in the evening, I carry the sun within my womb, which then I give birth to in the morning. So you get sort of these meditations there. But then also the link between us and the gods is also by performing Vedic rituals, ultimately I will attain the world of the gods. And I will attain a loka or a world or a realm that is like one of the gods. There's still a distinction between me and the gods because I'm not born. I'm sort of a god that is born, whereas the gods are sort of naturally gods. But we'll see, this becomes important in later texts as well. But you gain this realm of where you have influence. But then you're only there because you've become like one of the gods. So the same rules that apply to the gods now apply to you. So you're also still subject to Ritta. So you're also dependent on offerings that are made to you. The offerings that are made to you are, you know, say I die, I attain my own realm, and I'm there with the gods, having a great time. You guys will not perform offerings to me because you probably don't know, you know, somebody else will not perform offerings to me because they don't even know me. You know, that sort of you have the main gods you worship. So the responsibility for worshiping me and making offerings to me falls to my descendants, falls to my children. And that's why you find a lot of emphasis given in these texts on the importance of children. And we'll see more about that next week when we look at notions of dharma. But that's kind of in a nutshell the Vedic worldview, the way these Vedic texts think about the nature of reality and our place within it. Strong emphasis on practice, which we'll see differs, sort of contrasts greatly with some of the things we'll see later on. Strong sort of emphasis on the importance of not just action in general, but sort of dutiful action in accordance with Ritta and knowing your identity in relation to the bigger whole. Next week we'll look more into the notion of dharma and how that sort of then translates into sort of the bigger concerns of social concerns, and how that then leads to issues of caste and so on. So that's what we'll be doing next week.